The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, West Ham get a spanking. Aston Villa improve their ranking. Chelsea get a franking. And Todd Bowley's just, well, that's probably enough rhymes. We ask, as Chelsea lurch daily from comedy to crisis to comedy again, is genre master Frank actually the perfect fit? We talk Liverpool Arsenal and the most exciting James Milner stat you'll hear all week, and ponder if Saints could do City again. It's the Totally Football Show. Yeah, a little blazing squad there for you, Farry, who came all the way from Zimbabwe to the Leicester Square Theatre for Tuesday's live Totally Football Show. Boy, that must have been a tough journey home. You know those travelling fans who get tanked 6-0 and they've got to make that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Duncan Alexander's here with us. You were there. Duncan,
I was. Of course, yeah. A very enjoyable evening.
Well, I enjoyed it too. John McKenzie, nice to see you.
I was not there.
You weren't there. And neither was Charlie Eccleshare, and he's not here either. He's kind of a virtual. He's kind of like a Charlie GPR, if you will, up on our big screen. How you doing, Charlie?
I'm good, yeah. Very much just an approximation of me.
Exactly. Don Pfeiffer will be joining us on the approxo screen as well very shortly. He can only be with us, I think he's managing Chelsea at the moment. My shift actually took, I can't cover it, if anyone can do that.
I'll step in, yeah.
Nice.
Getting Glenn Johnson back for a bit.
Oh, yeah. That'll work. Thanks to everyone who came along to the Leicester Square Theatre on Tuesday night. We got a lot of mileage out of Duncan's James Milner stat. Do you want to just refresh everyone's
memories? It was a throwaway remark that you leapt upon like a wolf.
Well, see what Charlie and John, they're numbers-based people, make of this.
So James Milner's played in 1.2% of all English top-flight games ever since 1888.
Now, not just Premier League fixtures, Duncan's saying. Every single game played by any team, put them all together, and one in every 100 featured James Milner.
Yeah.
How many is the total?
Well, we passed 50,000 in January. Milner's obviously played just over 600 games. So, yeah, it all adds up.
Whew. What about in Premier League terms?
Nice, Charlie.
Oh, he must be up about 6-7%.
Really?
Well, probably higher, actually.
And he must have played in, what, 10% of the midweek, no, more even, of the midweek fixtures.
Yes, he played in 100% of Liverpool's games at Chelsea.
He did, didn't he? All right, you were covering that for us on Tuesday night.
Wow.
Were you, though? All right, well, a lot has happened in the last few days with fixtures and that. We have big wins for Leeds and Newcastle and more. But let's start by catching up on the week in Chelsea.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network and sponsored by LiveScoreBet. You can get the latest football betting odds at LiveScoreBet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
Saturday, the 2-0 defeat to Villa. Sunday, Graham Potter's dismissal. Tuesday, 0-0 with Liverpool, with Bruno Salter having his... Yeah, that's me. You're probably wondering how I got here moment. And the shadowy figure of Frank Lampard hovering in a box. Wednesday, the news that Frank is now taking over. The man who replaces the man who replaced Thomas Tuchel is the man Thomas Tuchel replaced. And that brings us full circle. Thursday... Let's ask Dom Fifield, who I think is about ready to join us now. Dom!
Hi.
Dom, first of all, nice to see Frank at Stamford Bridge on Tuesday. Was there any suggestion that he was in Chelsea's plans before he made that appearance?
Well, no, not really, but I suppose we'll find out the ins and outs on that over the course of the next 24, 48 hours. I mean, the very fact that he was in one of the co-owners' boxes and Chelsea were without a recognised first-team manager, and that indeed Bruno had picked his first ever team at any level for the game out on the pitch, I suppose that there was you could easily draw your own conclusions from that. Mm. He is available. Frank Lampard. He's a figure that obviously would lance some of the toxicity around Chelsea potentially, particularly amongst match going supporters. So on that basis, then there must have been some logic in pursuing him as an option to the end of the season.
And it has a certain symmetry to it. He took Chelsea to the knockout stages of a Champions League campaign only to see another man come in and take them on to glory. Now he gets a chance to kind of fulfil that legacy.
Well, the first game after he left, Tuchel's first game was against Wolves, and who Chelsea got this weekend.
No.
It's like a dream sequence. Frank's just woken up, and it's 2 years ago. It's fine.
You have some strange dreams.
What did I miss?
What do you think? Is it a good move, Dom?
Is it a good move? I don't know. I don't think Chelsea. I don't think Frank Lampard's going to inspire Chelsea to beat Real Madrid, because I don't think Chelsea are good enough necessarily to beat Real Madrid. Chelsea are a mid-table team at the moment. Mm. I don't think Frank is going to improve that dramatically. I think that some of the challenges that he will have to address at Chelsea are going to be very, very difficult, and they're almost, the situation is exacerbated now compared to when he was last year there. I mean, there were fringe players at Chelsea in his last spell who were complaining at a lack of involvement. Well, he's got an entire squad on the fringes at Chelsea now, given the number of first team players on the books there. But he is more experienced than Bruno Saltor. And let's be honest, I mean, it did feel a bit odd that Graham Potter's coaching staff were going to remain at Chelsea and oversee first team matters, despite the fact that Graham Potter and Billy Reid had been moved on. Mm. So I think that there is a logic in Lampard coming in with other Chelsea icons. If Ashley Cole is in the group, other people who have been there before, Joe Edwards would have been there before, Chris Jones will have been there before.
Is JT in there?
JT is at the club in a capacity at the moment. I don't think we'll see him around the first team, but, you know, I didn't think Frank Lampard was going to be in charge of the first team this time, last week. It's more about the atmosphere. I think that... I know this will... This is like kicking a hornet's nest in terms of online and people who are looking from the outside in, but I suspect that the majority of match-going supporters at Chelsea will welcome Frank Lampard back, going back almost back to the symmetry. I mean, going back to a familiar face, going back to someone they know, someone who knows the club. You know, we had this conversation a few weeks back about how Roy Hodgson going back to Crystal Palace was a, you know, retrograde and regressive step. Well, actually, in that moment, in the situation Palace were in, it made sense. I wonder whether this is the same with Chelsea, in as much as there has been so much toxicity. There is, you know, the atmosphere has been pretty dire there. It's been a desperate season for a lot of different reasons, and having a club icon return, even with his limitations as a manager, will at least give the crowd a bit of a rallying point for them. Whether it has the same effect on the players, we'll have to see, but for the crowd, it's important probably.
Okay, and in the meantime, Chelsea are progressing with their discussions with Luis Enrique and Julian Nagelsmann, is that correct?
Yeah, I imagine there'll be five or six candidates that they'll talk to. I mean, those guys would be the favourites at the moment, but that has to be, that is their priority behind the scenes. While Lampard is looking after the first team for the remainder of this season, for the 10 games or whatever it is in the Premier League and the Champions League campaign, they and their co-sporting directors have to come up with a coherent plan for the summer and beyond. The fly in the oil will be if Frank... Yeah, exactly. is whether Frank... If Frank Lampard does do something absolutely remarkable, then does he suddenly force his way into the reckoning? But
I mean, that is the narrative dream, right? That Lampard wins the Champions League and we see what decision Chelsea make there.
Yeah, Chelsea, with a man they plucked from the crowd at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He used to play midfield. He scored quite a lot of goals, did he?
I'm sure that's happened before, hasn't it?
Yeah.
With Chelsea.
What percentage of games has he played in the Premier League?
Dom, you were kind of marshalling a wonderful piece on The Athletic detailing some of the more extraordinary extravagances of recent months at Cobham and within Chelsea. Is the return of Frank even among the top five most surprising things of late?
I think it has to be up there, to be fair. I think it has to be. It's, Yeah, I mean, look, I've covered Chelsea since 2007 in one way or another, and there have been some fairly extraordinary moments over that period, not least with interim managers winning the Champions League and Europa League, actually. Mm. But this does feel a bit... It is one of the more remarkable twists. The unravelling of Potter's short time at the club was dramatic in its own way, and a lot of that has stemmed from mistakes from the ownership. Understandable mistakes, possibly, for new owners in English football. He didn't do well enough, but he was dealt a pretty difficult hand, I think, to work with. And the stuff about the sheer bloated nature of that playing squad and the number of bodies in the building from 11, you know, simultaneous 11 aside games and 9 aside games on neighbouring pitches, all made up of first team players. I mean, that is staggering and utterly unmanageable, whoever you are. Mm. I mean, they could have, I'm sure, Pep Guardiola in there, that, you know, all the best of the best, and I'm not sure that he would have been able to cope with that.
Tom, I just wanted to ask you something. With that bloated squad, how on earth did Chelsea go about selling all these players? Because we're told that clubs in Europe, you know, don't really have any money. So you're then looking at Premier League clubs, really. But, like, you know, Lukaku, they sold for, what was it, 100 million euros around, and then he just went out on loan. What sort of fees can they get for most of these players? And if they don't, even with the very clever amortization that Todd Boehly has done on all these contracts, I mean, surely they're going to be in pretty serious trouble. And do they just start letting players go for, you know, really small fees just to get them off the books?
I'm intrigued to see how that works out, because that is my suspicion. That I mean, we're hearing that Mason Mount, going into the last year of his contract, would cost the suitors £70 million. Well, that seems wildly unrealistic as far as I can work out. I don't see who would do that. And even if you're selling to a direct rival in the Premier League, a club that's competing for Champions League qualification as well, I struggle to see how they would be willing to pay £70 million for a player with 12 months to run on the deal. In terms of the accountancy, I guess all their youth team graduates are... I mean, that's clear profit on the books, because they didn't pay any fees for those guys. So you may find another wave of talented young players who maybe have been on the fringes at Chelsea and waiting for a chance, many of whom will be rated, having to move on. So you might see Levi Colwill leave, who's done well at Brighton this season. I mean, what happens to Conor Gallagher in the summer? There's Mason Mount in there as well. I mean, Trevor Chaloba, you could argue as well. He's sort of dropped off the scene a bit and was going to play last week against Villa, and then mysteriously wasn't on the team sheet on match day. I mean, it's that kind of player that may have to be moved on, and that will be a painful process. It will be painful for the supporters to accept as well, that all these young, talented academy graduates are being moved on. They're the ones that are leaving, whereas, you know, their priority might be to move on some of the higher paid recruits that haven't really hit the ground running.
Mm. Well, the immediate issue for Chelsea is the manager. This week, Frank Lampard is their solution. John, you went back to the piece The Athletic wrote 2 years ago when he was actually the problem. What do you draw from that?
Yeah, there's a lot of people talking about how he's going to solve the mood at Chelsea, but the piece that we put out after he left the first time round, before the remontada, there's lots of quotes that are not particularly flattering about his ability of dealing with players. So a quote here from a source: that the problem was the manager didn't talk to the players. Well, only the ones he liked. I know of players who weren't in the team that didn't hear from him for many months. That's very frustrating for a player, because you like to know how you can do things better, what the manager is thinking. It's crazy. And obviously that was with a regular size squad. So now there's even more players to throw into the mix as well. And there was a situation with Marcus Alonso where he left at halftime when he'd been subbed off. And it said what happened with Alonso raised a red flag in terms of Lampard being able to control the dressing room.
Right.
But at least this time he won't have many months in which not to speak to the players. So that could actually help his cause.
He could try and speak to every player and might run out of time. So,
do they need to buy more chairs at Cobham, Dom? Is that one of the issues?
I did wonder that, yeah, possibly.
Players sitting on the floor.
Getting changed on a bench, wasn't it? Or
getting changed on a bench outside the at the dressing rooms, and sitting on the floor in the media suite. I mean, that amazes me, because I've been in pretty busy press conferences over the years in that media suite, and I don't remember a journalist ever sitting on the floor. They'd stand occasionally if Jose Mourinho was in full swing. But yeah, well, that is a scenario. I mean, that is how ridiculous it's become, and that's not even including the 10 or so first team players that are currently out on loan.
Mm. All right. Well, it was a goalless draw with Liverpool the other night, which takes Chelsea's goal scoring this season, remarkable given their squad, to Duncan, 29 in 29. Which is the lowest they've had at this stage of a campaign since the 1920s. Do you see that improving vastly against Wolves this weekend?
Maybe, because they did actually create some good chances. They
two disallowed goals, of course.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, we've talked about how this season's endless before, but the fact that we started the season 4 years ago, whatever it was, and
in Frank Lampard's case,
yeah, and Lampard was bad at Everton, and then Potter was this sort of systems manager, comes in at Chelsea. Lampard's the only manager probably ever in the history of Premier League that will have lost to Nathan Jones. and now he's back at Chelsea and Potter's out. So, I don't think anyone can really figure out what's going to happen in the next few weeks. Who knows? You know, Glenn Hoddle will be back by May.
Possibly so. Don, before we let you go, just a quick question from Matthew Reed, who says, what should Chelsea's realistic targets be if Lampard returns till the end of the season?
He's a stopgap. I mean, if they can qualify for European competition of some kind, then brilliant. And that's not outlandish. I mean, they could do that. It's such a congested division in terms of the race for the Europa League places. But to be honest, it feels more like let's just get to the end of the season and start the long-term planning process again.
So the target is, can he help with the passage of time passing?
Yeah.
As long as he doesn't stop time,
he will have his own job. Targets. In fairness to him, I mean, he will want to go out. He will want to go out in a better fashion than he did last time.
Right.
You know, his I was at that defeat at Leicester. That defeat at Leicester when he lost his job last time around, and it was a fairly miserable period as for Chelsea supporters and fans. And he'll just want to go out with, you know, Stamford Bridge singing his name, I guess.
Dom Fifield. John, you must feel pretty gutted because you've just done a big tifo on why everyone wants Julian Nagelsmann and not on Frank.
Yeah, it's disappointing. I've really missed the boat on that one.
Could you say, just, you know, briefly in a nutshell, what will tactically his arrival mean for this team?
Frank Lampard or Julian Nagelsmann?
No, this is about Frank.
Okay.
You can't repurpose your pointless Nagelsmann tifo piece here, mate. You revised the wrong subject.
Dear. Yeah, now I'm in the exam situation, right? And I haven't done my revision, but the last time around, it was generally sort of very flamboyant attacking play with very flamboyant attacking players with something of a soft centre and the ability to concede in defensive transitions. I don't necessarily think that that we won't not see that.
Right.
There we go.
Okay. Against Wolves this weekend and then away against Real Madrid next week, who warmed up midweek with a 4-0 victory over Barcelona in the Copa del Rey semi-finals, booking a place against Osasuna in the finale, as they call it, sort of.
El finale.
El finale, I think. Yeah. All right, on to part two next with other things that happened midweek and that Newcastle win at West Ham. Woof.
This is the Totally Football Show, sponsored by LiveScore Bet. With Bet Builder from LiveScore Bet, you can combine markets from thousands of options to create your own bet on the biggest football fixtures in the Premier League, the Champions League, the EFL, and around the world. So if you think you can successfully pick the first goal scorer, the final score, the total number of corners, and whether there'll be a red card, then use Bet Builder from LiveScore Bet to make up to 6 selections and get a single bet with the combined odds. Or if you can't make up your mind, you can choose from the pre-built quick bet options. Bet Builder from LiveScore Bet. Building a bet just got easier. Find out more at livescorebet.com or by downloading the LiveScore Bet app on Android and iPhone. It's over 18s only. Full account terms apply. And of course, please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Midweek results alongside your Chelsea 0, Liverpool 0. There was Aston Villa winning 2-1 at Leicester with, yes, Ollie Watkins scoring for a sixth away game in a row and a magnificent late winner from Bertrand Traore. A 2-1 win for Leeds at home to Nottingham Forest. Brighton winning 2-0 at Bournemouth. And how about that Evan Ferguson goal, by the way?
Cleared away by Senesi, it's only as far as Matoma. Yeah! Ferguson flicks it in! It is a fantastic finish from a youngster who seems to have the world at his feet. No wonder they rave about Evan Ferguson.
What would you call that? Because I saw that in Italy, and I was, they would call it there un colpo alla Bettega, Roberto Bettega, who's famous for that.
Kind. That's what I call it as well.
Yeah. Would you? Nice.
It's not a back heel, though, is it? Some people call it a back heel. It's a sort of
instep flick. Yeah. Okay. And what is, does that have a name in the kind of English football heritage? Is there a player who owned that kind of a manoeuvre?
We've never done that in English.
I mean, the most obvious English example is probably Zola, isn't
Zola,
it?
Yeah.
So we call it, he's done a Zola.
The first time I ever saw do that was Hernan Crespo.
Okay.
For, I think it would have been Parma. And I remember just seeing it on a, probably presented by you, a roundup of the week's goals. And he did that. And I was like, wow, I've never seen anyone do this before. What is this move? It was incredible.
You see it a lot now, don't you?
Yeah.
I think so.
I did it once in a five-a-side game. No, for real.
Right.
It was the first time. I was playing football with my ex's dad. And,
okay.
and it was the winner, last minute winner from a corner, flicked it in.
Were you on the same team as your ex's dad?
Yeah, yeah.
And had the relationship already ended in an amicable fashion?
No. It was currently ongoing. It was,
oh right, okay.
Yeah, it was the first time I'd played football with him, so I wanted to make
sure. What was the XG on that show?
The XGF, yeah.
Very nice. Good. Anyway, that's what happened in those games. Then, of course, on Wednesday we had another two fixtures, which saw Man United beating Brentford 1-0, measure of revenge there for Ten Hag, and a 5-1 thumping for West Ham at home to Newcastle. Who can tell me about that game?
This was, watching the goals back again in quick succession, felt like watching a lowlights reel from 90s football. You know, there's that, was it crap 90s football on Twitter? It, actually, all of the goals felt like that a whole season in 1994. It was absolutely abject defending all the way across the board. And I don't know, it feels as though West Ham really reached the end times.
Do you think?
It's hard to see how you come back from something like that.
Well, so they're one of four teams on 27 points, essentially three of them being outside the bottom three on goal difference. They have a game in hand on the other three, but there was something about that performance which has seen this view.
Weirdly, I kind of think the opposite side. Oh. It was such a bad, odd performance. It feels like a complete outlier. Like, I think they can actually just, you know, resign it to the dustbin of history. But, I mean, you're right. It's only the second time Newcastle have ever scored five or more away from home. And the previous time was at Coventry in 1998, which is the most 90s sort of fixture.
Which I think was on that comp I was talking about, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, it was just all five goals were... There was at least one or two players culpable. So,
I mean, I think there were a couple of things from this game. I thought one, I think the most entertaining bit was, I love the genre of some players celebrating in front of away fans and they're just getting sworn at or whatever. But Wilson doing the Macarena and getting that treatment from children swearing at him was just quite a funny sort of image. He seemed to be really reveling in that. And I was thinking as well, and Duncan, you might have some thoughts on this, the precedent for a team fighting a relegation battle while simultaneously having a European knockout tie to navigate. Because I just wonder what West Ham are going to do. I think next Thursday they travel to Belgium for the first leg of their Conference League quarterfinal. You know, that surely pales into insignificance in a way into staying in the Premier League. But at the same time, if they were to do a Villa from whenever it was, 2009, and sort of sack off Europe, that could also be very unpopular and have a damaging effect. So it's quite a strange dilemma that David Moyes will have.
I mean, this is why you go back sort of 10, 15 years and you'd get teams like Bolton who go onto Europe and then completely sacked. They spend the whole previous season.
Yeah,
going,
but they do it earlier, wouldn't they?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the last couple of seasons, we've seen mid-table Premier League teams really try and progress. And I actually looked earlier, and if you look at all the Premier League teams who played more than 50 games last season in all competitions, it's Chelsea and Liverpool in 63, then Leicester, Man City, West Ham and Spurs. They're the six. And you can make a good argument that all six of those teams have declined a bit this season. Obviously, City is a bit more of a debatable one. But Chelsea, Liverpool, Leicester, West Ham, Spurs, I think, and you look at who played the fewest games last season, it was Newcastle, just played 40.
Right.
So I think it's kind of underrated how much the previous season does impact on the following campaign.
Okay. Newcastle, who, for all the errors that West Ham contributed, were in magnificent form in their fourth win on the spin after that slightly sticky patch they had, reinforcing their hold on third place, heading directly towards the Champions League. Any thoughts on how things have come together for Eddie Howe?
Well, I think after the World Cup break, there was suggestions of teams playing differently against them. And I think that happens a lot when a team sort of rises from the lower reaches of the table towards the top, that the assumption is that for most teams we can go out and play our normal game against them. But obviously Newcastle challenging for that top four spot. And I think what happened post World Cup has been that there's been teams who have just sat in a little bit more against them, forced them to try and break them down, played over their press, which is really impressive. And I think the combination of those things is always going to impact a team like Newcastle. So, yeah, good to see them scoring a lot of goals again in recent weeks. But, yeah, as we've said, West Ham didn't exactly make it hard for them, particularly the, I think it was the second goal where Fabian Scher just plays the ball from the back line straight
sort of
through.
Toe punt. It wasn't even a good pass, really, but it just went through. And the offside line was asymmetrical, to say the least.
And very spread apart. There was cavernous gaps between the back four.
One interesting thing from Eddie Howe, actually, was obviously everyone knows Callum Wilson's got a great record against West Ham. That's now 12. You know, his next favourite opponent's on six, which I think equals a Premier League record in terms of a gap between favourite opponents. But they asked him, Eddie Howe, after the game, did you pick Wilson because of that record? And normally that's where managers go, oh, I don't listen to any of that stuff. That's, you know. But Eddie Howe was like, yeah, no, I did think about that and thought I'll put him in. So
nice.
Yeah, liked it.
Excellent.
I mean, having those options, having Isak and Wilson, I mean, that is a lovely option to have, to be able to give Isak a rest. And also, I think just with how they've turned it around, I know he was playing in their bad run as well, but it looks like he's settled a bit as well over the last few weeks. I mean, it's small margins as well, isn't it? Because the game that got them back on track was Wolves, when Pope was lucky to get sent off. Then Forest was a late win. But then, yeah, since that, they've really kicked on since then, obviously, with that very deserved win against United and this. And now, yeah, I have to say, I didn't see it coming, especially because there's that often that post-League Cup final lull for teams, whereas they've done the opposite. They've rebounded really strongly after that.
Yeah, they've got Brentford next. That's Saturday afternoon. Brentford, who were playing Newcastle's top four rivals, Man United, midweek, and losing 1-0 to them. But they're a different kettle of fish at the, is it 3G Arena?
G-Tech
Arena.
Yeah.
Right. At that
place. G-Tech Community Stadium.
Mm. Yeah, that's the one. Yes. Man United's 1-0 win against Brentford. What's noteworthy about that? Marcus Rashford with his 28th of the season.
Yeah, United were good here because Brentford have done really well against the traditional big six this season. And actually, I thought United found it easier to find space than a lot of teams have done against this Brentford defence. I wonder if Brentford are slightly now just going to tail off a little bit. I mean, we'll see how they respond against Newcastle. But yeah, I thought this was actually quite good from United, having had a few pretty ropey performances.
Right, they're moving to fourth place with this win above Spurs. We'll hear more about Tottenham later on from you, Charlie, because you're back on the Tottenham beat. Man United, those 3 points clear of Spurs with a game in hand as well. So not looking great for the Lily Whites. Brentford facing Newcastle that Saturday. Man United are going to be at home to Everton. How much trouble are Everton in?
Everton, I mean, I was at Goodison on Monday night.
Right.
For the Everton Spurs game. And they rallied really well from going a man down and a goal down and were well worth their point. And I think they've improved so much under Sean Dyche. It is just this issue, they can't really score goals.
Right. Well, that and the other issue about their FFP.
Right, yeah.
But that won't get applied this season.
That's a pretty major one.
That won't get applied this season. No. Okay.
I mean, that's more just adds to the catastrophe were they to go down, then suddenly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they're in huge trouble.
All right. But on the field, four games unbeaten, and they are fractionally outside the bottom three, so that's nice. As you look at that coagulation of teams down there, Wolves on 28. Well, Leeds, actually. Your Leeds, John. What a win for them this midweek. So they're on 29, a point behind Palace, and you've got Wolves on 28. Then all those teams, West Ham, Everton, Nottingham Forest and Bournemouth on 27, and then Leicester and Saints.
Yeah, well, Frank Lampard's got a nice buffer there of 9 points to the relegation coagulates. But yeah, really good performance from Leeds to get 3 points. And we're at that point of the season where, you know, you don't really care about how you do it. You've just got to get points on the board. I was looking at some of their underlying numbers. I know you like to hear about how the underlying numbers are doing, Jimbo. And there's suspicions that Javi Gracia has been a little bit lucky in his time.
Really?
Yeah, just, you know, their Leeds are running a little bit rich in terms of their expected goals. I've had a look at a few different models and, it suggests that we've maybe picked up about 4 points more than you might have expected from the underlying numbers that we have. Obviously, that doesn't matter at this point because at this point you just put the points on the board and you say thank you very much. Mm. But I know that Phil Hay has put a piece out this week looking at maybe Javi Gracia staying on beyond the summer. And I think on the basis of the underlying numbers, it's probably a little bit too early to be saying...
Is it no Gracia?
Well, yeah, maybe. Thank you very much.
Here's a question from, and I don't know quite how to, but he's using characters that are not part of any alphabet I'm familiar with, but it might be Felsi. Question for John. What has Javi Gracia done differently at Leeds? And ask possibly Felsi. Would it be sustainable over a season or is it just good for the short term?
Yeah, I think the way that I would characterise it is he's just sort of gone back to basics in terms of playing solid football, getting his team into a structure that, you know, you're going to get the most out of your players. You're not going to... I mean, with Jesse Marsh, the big thing was you're generating chaotic moments and you're putting your team in a situation where they're going to be better prepared for those chaotic moments than the opponent. And I guess the idea is that when you're a team who maybe you expect to be mid-table, you can sort of game the system a little bit. You can get more than you might do out of the game than you would do with the players that you have. And Gracia, I think, has gone the other way now. So it's very much, we'll be defensively solid. We'll make sure we're not giving up too much for the opposition. We'll take our chances when they come. And I think the upside of that is that Leeds have looked a lot more solid defensively, but the downside is that you don't look as though you're going to generate as many chances as maybe you would. At the moment, that's fine because we're overperforming our expected goals, so we're scoring maybe more at a higher rate than you would expect. But I think that the expectation with the underlying numbers is that at some point you regress.
Catch up,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the big question is what then? Do you end up with a manager who's going to keep you in the league? That's probably fine for what Leeds want at the moment. But for me, I think we're in a really nice situation where we were being linked with a lot of very good managers after Jesse Marsh left. And I feel like just settling with Javi Gracia might be a little bit too negative.
Who did you have your eyes on?
Well, there was a few exciting managers. So Iraola, Andoni Iraola, who's at Rayo Vallecano, who's a former pupil of Marcelo Bielsa. Can you say that? I guess you can.
Disciple.
Yeah. And then Arne Slot as well at Feyenoord was another one. So certainly managers in that sort of ballpark where they haven't quite made the big jump up to you know the right at the top levels, but there's a suggestion that they could do that, and I think those are the sort of managers that Leeds should be looking at.
Right, sleeping giants like Leeds, of course. It's an interesting game coming up for you in the short term this weekend when you take on Crystal Palace, who are a point and a place above you in the table. Do you know the last time that Palace actually won at Elland Road, John? Do you? In the Premier League,
I'd say it's probably a game since 1992. Yeah.
It was since 1992. Yeah, nice. I'm looking at August 1997. Paul Warhurst and Attilio Lombardo. Oof,
we can't get much more 1997 than that pair.
Can you not?
That was, they made a really great start to the season that year. I think they won two out of their first three games, and that was about as good as it got.
This Palace, though, is different, isn't it? It's got the Roy factor. It's had 31 shots last weekend.
Yeah?
Yeah. What do you think? Are we going to see more of that kind of Roy ball?
I do like the fact that off the back of one game, things are so short-term, so off the back of one game, it's now a smart thing to do to go with the sort of safe pair of hands. Like, well, it's worked for Palace. It's like, they played one game. Which they won with a, what was it, a 94th minute goal or something.
That's all you need at the bottom of the table at the moment, though, isn't it? What, you win true, one yeah. game. I think Leeds jumped up something like six places by winning in the midweek.
Did they?
They jumped up something like three places from drawing level against Forest midweek as well. So it's all very close. And
it's so tight.
I'm not willing to say that any team is safe on the basis of a win, because it's, you know, a couple of games later and everyone else can be ahead of you.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. I mean, as long as you don't support one of the teams down there. But like in terms of the apart from Southampton and Palace, who do seem to be the bread in the relegation sandwich, they never seem to move much now. But everyone else jumps about all over the place. And yeah, I mean, this, you kind of feel like whoever wins this Leeds Palace game might be all right, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Is this the week?
Maybe.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Forrest, meantime, we had Daniel saying that he was very concerned about Steve Cooper's future, particularly if they were to come a cropper in that match. Midweek, Forrest putting out a statement saying that there's no upheaval planned at the club, which is, I think, popularly viewed as good
the
news.
The dreaded vote of confidence.
Wow.
It seems to have the fan confidence, though, which apparently is what matters these days. So there we go.
There you go. All right, well, coming up at the weekend, of course, there's a particularly big game at Anfield where Liverpool are taking on Arsenal. So let's get on to that and Saints, Man City and Spurs as well next.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, sponsored by LiveScore Bet. You can get the latest football betting odds at livescorebet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
Sunday, 4:30, it's Liverpool-Arsenal. Saturday, we'll have already seen Arsenal's title rivals Man City away at Saints. Think that's an easy game? Think again. City lost 2-0 at St Mary's in the Carabao Cup in January. They didn't even have a shot on target. Wow.
Nathan Jones masterclass, yeah.
Yeah.
Very different now.
Indeed. Well, Liverpool-Arsenal, I guess, is the headline fixture. Arsenal haven't won at Anfield in the Premier League in over a decade. Is this the season that all that changes?
Well, this is such the kind of acid test for Arsenal, because it is a fixture they've been terrible in over that period. I mean, since Klopp came in, they've just been routinely battered at Anfield. I mean, to be honest, they've suffered a lot of batterings against Liverpool at the Emirates as well. It's been a dreadful matchup for them for a long time. Obviously, they won this, they beat Liverpool in October, and that felt really significant. I think for a lot of people, that was like, oh, maybe they are actually legit. But this is the one. I mean, if they can, you know, this feels like they're in the big leagues now. If they really want to compete with City, if they want to keep them behind them, a draw even probably isn't good enough. Because if they do draw, and assuming City beat Southampton, then it's back in City's hands as well as Arsenal. It would mean then that if City won all their games, because they play Arsenal, they'd be champions. So it's really, really huge. I think missing Saliba is massive, as we expect that Arsenal probably will be. He's an outstanding defender, and the drop-off to Rob Holding is pretty big, though Holding's done well in his two games, albeit against Palace and Leeds, so this would be a big step up. But, you know, I think if Arsenal are to win this game, they need to sort of play this current Liverpool team rather than, you know, Liverpool, this kind of terrifying entity. That said, Liverpool's home form has actually still been really good, despite how awful they've been away. They haven't conceded in the league in 2023. So it will be tricky.
They haven't had a home game since that 7-0 win over Man United. When you say play this current Liverpool team, one interesting thing at midweek was the fact that Klopp took some big names out of the side. Some people wondering if that was in preparation for this Arsenal fixture. Salah, Trent and Robbo on the bench and Virgil van Dijk off ill.
I think they'll all come back in, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it feels like that was partly A, to sort of say to them after City, you were awful as a team and I want to show how annoyed I am, but also knowing that, you know, Arsenal's on the horizon, three games in, what would it be, from Saturday through to Sunday. And that feel, I think, you know, I think Liverpool still feel they should almost win that game because of how good their home form has been and because of how much they've beaten Arsenal over the last few years. So, yeah, I'd expect those guys to all come back. And I think Klopp's already said that Van Dijk will be available.
Which is the sort of game that Liverpool thrive in, right? And even just looking through the results that Liverpool have had this season, they've beaten City twice, including the Community Shield result. They've beaten Newcastle twice. They've beaten Napoli in the Champions League. They beat, I mean, does Spurs count? Maybe not. But then the big win over Manchester United as well. It feels as though Liverpool lack consistency, but they definitely have a giant killing performance in them. So this is the sort of game that will suit them, I think.
You think Liverpool are coming back into it with this one? And Charlie, you seem to feel that as well, Duncan.
I'm more confident for Arsenal, I think. I just think that Liverpool's defending is so bad, they still got up so many chances. And even that Man United game, 7-0, but it was a very strange 7-0. It was everything Liverpool hit went in. I think they had 8 shots on target and scored 7 times. So, and Arsenal are a much better team than Manchester United.
Will James Milner play, do you think?
Nudge it up to 1.3%. I mean, he did play against Arsenal for Leeds back in 2004, when Arsenal were very good the last time they were, in the hunt, I guess. So I think, and Arsenal have been so good away from home. That's where they've built their title challenge, really. Aaron Ramsdale's on 9 clean sheets away from home this season. Only 2 goalkeepers in the history of the Premier League have kept double figures for clean sheets away from home. Petr Cech at Chelsea a couple of times, and Edison a couple of times as well. So, I mean, it's their away performances, and that display at Fulham a few weeks ago was the most champion-y sort of feeling I've got of any team this season. But it is a big test. It's the final challenge before the end of level boss, which is City at the end of the month.
I mean, statistically, I mean, Arsenal are 8 points clear of City and they've got 7 points more away from home and only 1 point more at home than what City have. So Duncan is right. You know, the numbers bear that out, that it is really, the difference has come from their away form. And they've got to go and better what City did, because John mentioned City lost this fixture 1-0 earlier in the season. Arsenal need to again find a way of keeping an away clean sheet and winning at a ground where they haven't done since Arteta was playing in 2012.
I would like to clarify that I do think Arsenal are the favourites here. But
oh, you do?
In terms of the tactical matchup between the two. So, for example, we saw Liverpool play Man City recently and Liverpool scored the first goal from exploiting Man City's desire to get all of their players forward, control the game, turn the ball over, and then get hit on the break. So I think that's the sort of thing that could decide this game, and that's what decided the original fixture when Manchester City lost at Anfield as well. So I think Arsenal will probably control the game, but they will always be open for being hit on the break in behind, and if Liverpool could go ahead and can keep ahead, then anything could happen.
Well, indeed. Man City will have already played their fixture by the time Arsenal take the field at Anfield. The gap at the top could be down to just 5 points. Man City are at Southampton, 5:30 on Saturday evening. They've won 7 in a row in all competitions, City. They've won their last 10 in a row against teams starting the day bottom of the Premier League table. In fact, they haven't conceded a goal against a team bottom of the table since far away April 2014. That's almost a decade.
They've won 15 of their last 17 Premier League games in April, City. They're very much the second Death Star of football. It's like, oh, this football team is fully operational. And you know, the gap between Arsenal and City is misleading, I think, at the moment, and it is very close. But,
misleading, why? Because City have a game in hand?
Have a game in hand, and they've still got to play Arsenal, and Arsenal have got some tough games, but this is, we've said that many times this season, and they keep coming through. And you know, like, things are falling for us. Like, missing out on Mudryk and getting Trossard. Trossard's been brilliant. He got a hat trick, didn't he, at Anfield for Brighton this season. So,
oh yeah,
with his left foot.
Yeah. So, wow. I think he could be a key player as well. I mean, I think Arsenal have got so many attacking weapons that, and we know Liverpool's. Chelsea should have won pretty easily in midweek. So, I mean, Alisson is arguably the player of the season in some respects. He's kept Liverpool as high as they are, really.
You mentioned there the inevitability of Man City at the end of seasons. Do we think that that's... Because it feels like every season, Man City maybe drop a few points in the first half of the season and then they just ride home to the finishing line and they just don't drop anything. And that's going to be the pressure that's on Arsenal, right?
100%.
Yeah, I mean, Sam Lee's written a piece on this topic, I think went up today, and City do tend to go, once they enter that beast mode, they really, we know how adept they are. I mean, they've, in the past few seasons, they've won 18 in a row, 14 in a row, 15 in a row, 12 in a row. So, yeah, you look at their remaining games as well, and whereas Arsenal have got Liverpool away, obviously they play City away, and Newcastle away, there aren't as many of those kind of games for City. I mean, they've got some tricky away games. They've got like Brighton and Brentford, but they don't have those kind of big monster away games. So, yeah, we'll see.
I guess we will. Currently on 7 wins in a row in all competitions. Now, also coming up this weekend, we've got Aston Villa, who will be hosting Nottingham Forest. Last time these two teams met at Villa Park was in 2018. It finished 5-5.
Going on again and setting up Graben. He's in and he scores! Lewis Graben, it's 5-5!
Wouldn't that be extraordinary? Yes. If we saw a repeat of that. Tammy Abraham got 4 goals for Villa. Incredible. Villa, of course, have just beaten Leicester midweek. Leicester this weekend will be trying to bounce back as they take on Bournemouth. Bournemouth, who were defeated 2-0 by Brighton. And here's the game that I really want to talk about. Brighton themselves will be up against Spurs. Charlie, you're back in the saddle with Spurs. How is that going with you? For you?
Very well. Yeah, the first couple of weeks were pretty crazy with Conte sacking and then Paratici getting banned. This week's been a bit calmer, just the sort of slightly crazy game on Monday.
Right.
So, and then, all roads leading to Saturday.
Let's talk a little bit about Monday's performance. Spurs were a goal up and a man up against a team in the relegation zone who are also the lowest scorers in the Premier League. And then what happened?
You know the rest, yeah. I mean, Spurs were very, very passive after going ahead, even with the extra man. I think in the 5 minutes after they scored, they had 17% of the ball against 10-man Everton. I looked at the numbers for the piece I wrote on the game, and in the period after, they were completely outplayed by Everton. I mean, you know, Everton had more shots, more possession, etc. And yeah, I mean, it just looked like a team lacking the confidence to really go on, be aggressive, hammer home the advantage that they had. And you know, and talking to Stellini afterwards, was asking, you know, is this a technical thing? Is it a mental thing? And I think he's slightly at a loss, but it does look like a team that have taken a bit of a battering, you know, in terms of self-confidence during the season. Having a manager constantly telling them he doesn't think they're very good doesn't seem to have really had the desired effect. And I think it's a shame because they sort of battled reasonably hard for the first hour or so and then got into the position they wanted to be in and then just completely shrunk into themselves. In a way, it reminded me of the end of the Mourinho era when they kept drawing games from winning positions or even losing them. So, yeah, I think they need a good start in this game against Brighton because I think otherwise the fans could get pretty unhappy pretty quickly.
All right, Brighton, who are 4 points behind Spurs but have two games in hand on them. Obviously, a victory here would really improve their chances of leapfrogging Tottenham and maybe even making top four. To what extent do you think Spurs will be watching Brighton with an eye on the Brighton manager for the future?
Yeah, he's definitely a candidate, and I think a lot of the fans would really like him. We've done a survey of Spurs fans' various issues, and he was the third most popular candidate after Nagelsmann and Pochettino. I think as well, in general, for a lot of fans looking at Brighton are kind of the paradigm for how to run a football club. You know, when you look at their recruitment, style of play, managerial choices they've made, in lots of ways that Tottenham feel that they're not. So I think there will be some envious glances at Brighton, and in particular the way they play. I mean, Brighton are so positive, they look so well coached. And yeah, I mean, clearly De Zerbi could do his chances of getting an approach, should he want it, we don't know, with a good performance here. And Brighton did win this fixture last season in a game that I think did a lot for Graham Potter's reputation. They came and played really, really well and won, deservedly 1-0. It's Trossard, actually, who we mentioned earlier. He scored the only goal that day.
Of course, it's not just De Zerbi, is it? You've got world champions like McAllister. You've got the young prodigy Ferguson, Mittoma. Speaking of McAllister, producer Charles just sent me the post that Alexis McAllister... I'm not seeing this, and I haven't got the sound up. So Alexis McAllister, this is what, post the Bournemouth win, says, 100 games with this amazing club. Since I've arrived, I've received so much love and support from everyone at the club, and that's why I'm really grateful. Lovely, love you, Seagulls. And there's a track. Can we play this?
On the southern coast of England, there are seagulls flying. Still higher than before. It's as though they've been hoisted like a flag.
So that's the club anthem. You said while it was playing that it was really famous, John.
It touched me in a way that I haven't felt in years. So yeah, okay. I don't know. It must be something from my past.
It talks about an ocean, which is bigging up the English Channel a little bit for me.
I'm hearing from producer Charlie. He's got info. Johnny Wakeling, Where Seagulls Fly.
Right. Is he a local Sussex song?
I don't know.
Songmeister?
Ah, right. I'm hearing now that it might have something to do with Brighton's FA Cup run in 1983.
And Smith.
That's why score. It touches you. That's why
that's right, yeah.
It chimes.
2 years before I was born.
Yeah, but...
I felt something in the force.
I mean, that's a lovely gesture, isn't it, from Alexis McAllister. Maybe it was a big hit in Argentina.
Hmm.
Classy touch. It seems to have gone down well with the supporters, judging from the responses.
Well, it would.
So, fair play.
Yeah, deep cut from Brighton's past.
Nice. Yes.
Excellent. All right. So, Charlie, from a Spurs point of view, Brighton rolling into town in excellent form, a really underwhelming performance Monday night for Spurs, and a top four place, which looks like it might be heading for the hills. Any positive thoughts?
I mean, Spurs have had some big wins at home this season. They beat Chelsea and City, and both of those were under Stellini and Mason, with Conte was unwell for those ones. So, you know, they hope to channel that and, you know, come out and be positive and get the crowd behind them as they really were those days. Yeah, I think that those will be the benchmark performances, but there is a lot of trepidation from the supporters going into this one, definitely.
Mm. Do you see it as a good matchup from Spurs' point of view?
I believe that Spurs won in do you call it a return fixture when it's happened before? The first
reverse.
The reverse fixture.
Reverse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was fairly early on in De Zerbi's time, and I feel as though we are now very much deep within De Zerbi, Brighton territory now. He's got the team doing what they like to do. But they have dropped points recently in games where maybe they should have won. I know they put a huge amount of chances up against Brentford recently, and I think Leeds as well sort of scabbed a bit of a result against them too. So maybe that's the best hope for Spurs to just stay in there and hope to ride the variance.
Like a seagull.
Hoisted like a flag.
This is the start of a massive fortnight for Brighton, isn't it? Because they've got Spurs away, then they've got Chelsea away next weekend. Frank Lampard's Chelsea, sorry. And then the following weekend is Man United in the FA Cup.
Hmm.
And, you know, with the talk of De Zerbi, you know, maybe moving on next season somewhere, and I imagine some of their better players might be snapped up. I mean, this is a chance for Brighton to get into the Champions League and or win the FA Cup that might, you know, might not come around again.
If they get into the FA Cup, do you think Johnny will make another track, another banger?
I think we should demand that he comes out with another one, if he's alive.
Just a re-record, right?
No, we don't want to go Three Lines S. Shoddy remake.
Well, you're absolutely right, then. It's a huge fortnight. Nice. I think that's where we come to the end of today's Totally Football Show, listener. You're thinking the same thing, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah. Mm. Listener, we'll leave you with that. Many thanks to Charlie, to John, to Duncan, to Dom earlier, who joined us with such vim and enthusiasm earlier on, and producer Charlie. And you, enjoy the weekend. We'll have a fresh Totally for you on Monday, so hopefully see you then.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by LiveScore Bet. Get the latest football betting odds at livescorebet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
The Athletic.